dark musk, and just as he realized this, the light went out. In the sudden darkness, he heard a low, heavy sound, like breath, all around him, a single deep rumble that strung his veins together and trembled in his lungs. He crawled under a tarp in the corner and sat in a shuddering heap with the bucket still in his hands. It seemed to my grandfather that the sound was still in the air, as sure and constant as his own crazy heartbeat. The smell was there too, everywhere, lingering, the smell of wild things, fox or badger, but bigger, so much more of it. Something in the darkness moved, and the butcher's hooks, hanging in rows along the rafters, clinked against one another. And my grandfather knew that it was the tiger. The tiger was walking. He could not make out the individual footfalls, the great velvet paws landing one in front of the other, just the overall sound of it, a soft, travelling thump. My grandfather's chest was jolting, and he could already picture the tiger bearing down on him, but he thought of the Jungle Book. The way Mowgli had taunted Shere Khan at Council Rock, torch in hand, and he put his hand out through the tarp and touched the coarse hairs passing by him. And just like that, the tiger was gone. My grandfather heard the sound of footsteps, and moments later the deaf-mute girl was kneeling at his side with worry in her eyes. And then Mother Vera's voice, screaming in the distance.
My child! The devil has taken my child!
The deaf-mute girl helped my grandfather to his feet and led him to the door. From the smokehouse ramp, he could see the dark, empty field swimming with shadows, the villages, the snowdrifts. But not the tiger. The tiger was already gone.
Hattie Morahan continues to read The Tiger's Wife by Taya Obrecht at 2:30 tomorrow afternoon. The abridger and the producer was Elizabeth Allard.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Matt Lucas and Charles Dance are part of a star-studded cast for the second and final part of Summer Lightning at 3 o'clock. First, The Lost Mona Lisa, read by Nicholas Grace. Vincenzo Perugia is reckoned to be the thief. But what are his motives, and is he believable?
Winter is rarely Florence's finest season. It swirls down from the Apennines and settles in the bowl of the Arno River. Anticipating a busy Christmas, art dealer Alfredo Geri placed an advertisement in a number of Italian newspapers, offering to pay generously for fine artwork. One response stood out from the rest. It was dated the 29th of November, 1913, postmarked Place de la République, Paris, and signed Leonardo. The stolen work of Leonardo da Vinci is in my possession. My dream is to give back this masterpiece to the land from which it came. At first, Geri dismissed the letter as a prank or the delusion of an unhinged person, but something about it kept nagging. The Mona Lisa had been missing from the Louvre for more than 2 years, and in that time, lookalikes had been popping up all over Europe. She'd been spotted crossing the border into Switzerland, slinking out of France, hopping a freight train headed for Holland. It was almost inevitable that an offer of one of the false Mona Lisas would arrive in Alfredo Geri's morning mail. The dealer read the note again. If the waiting were over and he recovered the lost Da Vinci, he would be a hero and an even wealthier man. Jerry brought the letter to Giovanni Poggi, the director of the Uffizi Gallery. Poggi advised Jerry to write back, saying that he would have to see the painting to make an offer. 10th of December. Jerry's shop was unusually crowded. One customer stood out from the usual clientele. He browsed through the antiques leisurely, as if he had time to kill. After Jerry had ushered out the other customers, the man introduced himself. Leonardo had brought Mona Lisa home to Florence. By all accounts, the true Leonardo had been a Renaissance hunk. His stand-in was a slight, edgy man with a moustache waxed at the tips. He said that he was registered as Leonardo Vincenzo at the Albergo Tripoli Italia. The hotel, a short walk away, was close to the Renaissance home where Lisa del Giocondo had sat for the true Leonardo. Caught off guard by the unexpected turn of events, Jerry asked Leonardo to come back the next day at 3 o'clock. He did not want to examine Mona Lisa alone. 3 o'clock. 5 minutes. 7 minutes. 10 minutes. Then Leonardo appeared. He grasped Director Poggi's hand in both of his, saying how glad he was to shake the hand of the man entrusted with the art treasure of Florence. Poggi and Jerry had grown nervous waiting, and their apprehension deepened as they approached the Albergo Tripoli Italia. Leonardo seemed oblivious. It was his first trip to Florence, and like a tourist on holiday, he sauntered along, taking in the sights around him. According to Jerry, Leonardo raised the subject of payment before they left the shop, saying he wanted 500,000 lira. According to Leonardo, Jerry proposed the payment as they were walking to the hotel. He, Leonardo, had not taken the picture through a desire for gain. Whichever account is the true one, by the time they arrived at the hotel, an agreement had been reached to ransom Mona Lisa for the sum proposed. It remained only for Director Poggi to identify her unequivocally. Crowded in the small room, Leonardo locked the door behind them and, without a word, dragged a case from under the bed. It was white wood of medium size. He opened it and began dumping out the contents, all wretched objects, Jerry would say. Woolen underwear, a squashed hat, a mandolin, and a few paintbrushes. Leonardo then lifted a false bottom in the case. Under it was a package bundled in red silk, which he placed on the bed. He began to unwrap it. Jerry described the moment. To our amazed eyes, the divine Gioconda appeared intact and marvellously preserved. Director Poggi expressed reservation. He would have to bring Mona Lisa back to the Uffizi and study the painting beside other works by Da Vinci before he could validate its authenticity. Leonardo agreed without argument. Poggi and Jerry carried Mona Lisa down the stairs wrapped in her red silk mantle. They knew they had the true Mona Lisa in their arms. Although they had contained their excitement in front of her kidnapper, they were practically running, afraid Leonardo would change his mind and come after them. As they fled past the front desk with their package, the concierge stopped them and insisted on seeing what they had concealed in the red silk. The thief had walked out of the Louvre carrying Mona Lisa with no questions asked, but the director of the Uffizi was stopped trying to leave the Albergo Tripoli Italia, accused of filching a second-rate reproduction from one of the rooms. If the guardians of the Louvre had had the same curiosity, Jerry would say, the Gioconda would never have come to Florence. Once they were safely free of the hotel, Poggi called in the carabinieri. Leonardo was napping when the chief of the Florence police knocked on his door. The momentous arrest, 2 years in coming, was made with no fireworks. Leonardo was confident that his arrest was simply a formality. the Italian government had to put on a public show of anger. Then he would be released, handsomely rewarded, and hailed as a national hero. Napoleon had stolen Mona Lisa from Italy, and he had stolen her back to right the wrong. Like the robbery, the recovery dominated the news. The true identity of Leonardo was Vincenzo Perugia, a 32-year-old born in a small town near Lake Como. His Paris address was 5 Rue de l'Hôpital Saint-Louis. While the Paris police had been combing the world in search of a mastermind, a madman, or a millionaire, Mona Lisa had been holed up in the heart of Paris in a cheap room, less than 2 miles from the Louvre. Except for the fact that he had abducted Leonardo's masterpiece, Vincenzo Perugia was a thoroughly inconsequential man. He was a petty crook and sometime house painter who had worked as a glazier at the Louvre for 2 years. Grateful Italians, though, filled his jail cell with admiring letters, gifts, cigarettes, and sweets. If the mood in Italy was euphoric, the mood in France was incredulous. An Italian macaroni, the lone thief? The Italian constabulary was as sceptical. Their police chief was convinced the story was fictitious. The man did not match the crime, and his motive did not match the history. Vincenzo Perugia should have been a prime suspect. He was one of the glaziers at the Louvre who had constructed Mona Lisa's controversial glass-enclosed frame. Since he had put her in the frame, he knew better than anyone how to remove her. He had been summoned for questioning, and when he failed to appear, a detective had gone to his apartment. Perugia said that he was at work on the morning of the 21st of August. If they'd checked his alibi, they'd have found that he'd arrived at his job several hours late and told his boss that he had overslept. But his alibi was never corroborated, and he was never fingerprinted. Everyone at the Louvre had been fingerprinted, except the thief. After Perugia's arrest, a new team of investigators searched his Paris apartment. Photographs show a dingy room with an unmade brass bed. Soiled floral wallpaper covers the walls of the cupboard where Mona Lisa was stashed. They came away with a daybook, suggesting the thief's motives might not have been as pure as he pretended. Currency, not Napoleon, had been on Perugia's mind from the outset. A journal entry, dated 8 months before the heist, listed the names of art collectors and dealers in the United States, Italy, and Germany, including John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, Andrew Carnegie, and Alfredo Geri. At the trial, the prosecution uncovered evidence that Perugia, before contacting Geri, had approached London art dealers, the Duveens. Although initially he insisted he had acted alone, under questioning, Perugia implicated the Lancelotti brothers. They were macaroni too, and according to Perugia, they hid the picture and helped him construct the false-bottomed box. Perugia scoffed at the Paris investigators and mocked their scenario of the theft. Instead of slinking out of the side entrance at the Porte Visconti, as the French investigators surmised, he boasted that, wearing his workman's white smock, he had carried Mona Lisa in his arms down the front stairs of the Louvre and, on that bright August morning, had strolled home, where he deposited his captive in his apartment, then went to work. His boast conflicted with the testimony of the Louvre plumber Sauve, and with the evidence. The brass doorknob missing from a side entry had been recovered in the museum garden near the Porte Visconti, but after so many slights and resentments, belittled as a macaroni, he was evening the score. Finally, on the 4th of January 1914, Mona Lisa was welcomed home. She had left the Louvre a work of art. She returned an icon. By the time Vincenzo Perugia was brought to trial in June of that year, the drama had played out. No more gifts of cigarettes and dolci. In the pantheon of great criminals, real or imaginary, he was an embarrassment. A psychiatrist appointed by the court testified that he was exceedingly dumb. He was found guilty as charged and sentenced to 1 year and 15 days. According to one newspaper report, as the thief was led out of the courtroom in handcuffs, he was overheard saying, "It could have been worse." 6 weeks later, the defense lawyers appealed his sentence. During those weeks, the political climate in Europe had changed dramatically. Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated in Sarajevo, and on the 28th of July, Austro-Hungary declared war on Serbia, the first salvo of the First World War. On his release, Perugia joined the Italian army, serving honorably through the war, and in 1921 he married, moved back to France, and opened a paint shop in Haute-Savoie. Vincenzo Perugia, also known as Leonardo, served less than a year for pulling off the most audacious art heist in history. He never confessed who was behind the pinch felt round the world, but the idea that he was the lone thief seems implausible. The First World War swept the Mona Lisa caper off the front pages, but the story begged for more. Years later, a journalist for the New York Journal provided it.
Part 4 of The Lost Mona Lisa by R.A. Scotti was read by Nicholas Grace and produced by Duncan Minchell. In tomorrow's final reading, Vincenzo Perugia is arrested and the painting is returned to France. End of story? Not exactly.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello, this is Jim Lee at 3 o'clock, where the 60-minute drama today boasts a star-studded cast. On the way, scandalous revelations and a missing pig. Matt Lucas and Charles Dance star in the final part of Summer Lightning. Then as Tom discovers more about the secret garden in Tom's Midnight Garden, the 4 o'clock show delves into the history of the much-maligned garden gnome. And later, the detective monk Cadvar returns from the Crusades in A Light on the Road to Woodstock at 8:30. But first, will a whole host of dilemmas be happily resolved, restoring peace and harmony to Blanding's castle?
Summer Lightning by P.G. Woodhouse, starring Patricia Hodge, Charles Dance, Tim Pigott-Smith, Samuel West, Rachel Sterling, Jared Harris, Martin Jarvis and Matt Lucas, with Matthew Wolfe as Ronnie Fish and Lisa Dillon as Sue Brown. Ian Ogilvie is the voice of P.G. Woodhouse.
Beach posed himself in the doorway of Blanding's castle, looking, as he always did on these occasions, like the spirit of Blanding's welcoming the lucky guest.
Leave the door open, Beach. I think the smell of the wet earth and the flowers is so refreshing, don't you?
The butler did not. He was not one of your fresh air men. He cast an appraising eye on the girl who had just arrived with Lady Constance and found her, even by his own exacting standards of criticism, noticeably attractive.
I knew the shower wouldn't last long, Miss Schoonmaker.
No. I mean, no.
You must be wanting some tea after your journey.
Oh, yes.
It seemed to Sue Brown as if she'd been smiling brightly for centuries. The moment she'd alighted from the train and found her formidable hostess and this strangely sinister Mr. Baxter waiting to meet her, she'd begun to smile brightly and had been doing it ever since.
The rain has stopped, Mr. Baxter. You must show Miss Schoonmaker the rose garden before tea.
I shall be delighted, Miss Schoonmaker.
A momentary panic gripped Sue. She feared that already this man had probed her secret, that she was not Myra Schoonmaker, merely Sue Brown, chorus girl, on a mission to make her darling Ronnie realize that she loved only him. In Baxter's glance, it seemed to her, there shone suspicion. Such, however, was not the case. Rupert Baxter's glance was almost, in fact, a loving glance. The good looks which he saw, and the wealth which he had been told about, were undeniably beginning to fan the hidden fire.
Well, how nice and old everything is here. What is that funny-looking gargoyle thing over there?
That is my brother Galahad.
Oh, no, I meant...
Galahad, this is Miss Myra Schoonmaker.
Really? Is it? Good Lord.
How do you do?
How are you, my dear? I know your father intimately.
Oh.
Haven't seen him lately, of course. Must be 25 years since we met.
I wasn't born then.
And here's my niece, Millicent. My dear, this is Miss Schumacher.
Hello there.
Oh, hello. You're Ronnie's friend. The Miss Schumacher Ronnie met at Biarritz.
That's correct. How do you do?
But I'm sure Ronnie told me that you were very tall.
I suppose almost anyone seems tall to that boy. What?
Sure.
Millicent, have you seen Ronald anywhere?
Not since lunch. I suppose he's out in the ground somewhere.
Miss Schumacher, Ronald will be surprised to find you here. Your telegram did not arrive till after lunch, so he does not know that you were planning to come today. And now Mr. Baxter is going to show Miss Schumacher the rose garden.
Oh, I...
No, he isn't. I am. Old Johnny Schumacher's little girl. Great fellow, old Johnny. Why, there are 100 things I want to discuss. Now, come along, my dear. Sun's coming out already. Well...